From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports.
I would argue there's no more important state-to-state relationship for 21st century security, stability, you name it, than between the two great powers of the US and China.
On this special holiday edition of FSN Reports, we journey into the rapidly expanding realm of cybersecurity. Award-winning author Peter Singer helps us navigate the many forms of cyber realities, from the anonymous hacker group, the ongoing cyber conflict between the US and China, and why it's probably time you rethought your password.
As long as we're using the internet, we will have cybersecurity and cyber war issues to deal with. And so what we need to do is change our mentality towards it, understand the issues, and then we can better manage them.
That's our extended interview with Peter Singer after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. After a day of pressure from the Syrian opposition and the US, the United Nations has rescinded its invitation to Iran to participate in this week's peace conference in Geneva. The Syrian opposition had threatened to boycott the talks unless UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon withdrew the invitation, which was only extended to Tehran over the weekend. Reporting on a day of drama from our bureau at the UN in New York, Nick Harper.
In less than 24 hours, Iran got invited and then uninvited. The UN Secretary-General's spokesperson, Martin Nertzky, reading out the decision.
He has decided that the one-day Montreux gathering will proceed without Iran's participation.
The invitation from the UN Secretary-General, Ban Ki-moon, initially angered the US and led Syria's main opposition party to threaten boycotting the conference. The problem being, the US was convinced that Iran, as Syria's longtime ally, did not back the main aim of the Geneva II talks, namely to set up a new transitional government, a condition that was laid out in the Geneva I agreement. And then Iran proved them right, publicly saying it would not attend the talks if it had to accept those preconditions. That admission effectively cleared the way for the Secretary-General to withdraw his invitation.
Meanwhile, Iran has started curbing its enrichment of uranium, according to the UN's nuclear watchdog. It's part of a deal with the US, Russia, China and European powers struck last November. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague says if Iran sticks to the deal, international sanctions will be eased.
We will be fulfilling our side of the deal, the suspension of those sanctions listed in the agreement with Iran. Of course, other sanctions will be maintained. This is limited and proportionate sanctions relief. And then we will get to work at a very early stage, as early as next month, on the negotiation of a comprehensive deal to settle the Iranian nuclear issue.
Mr. Hague and his fellow European foreign ministers have agreed to send troops to the Central African Republic to try and resolve the conflict there. The move came as a new interim president was elected in the country. From FSN's Europe desk in Brussels, Jack Parrock reports.
A meeting in Brussels of foreign ministers from across Europe decided to send up to 1,000 troops to the Central African Republic in a bid to put an end to continuing violence between Christians and Muslims. 1,600 French troops are already there. Poland, Sweden, Belgium and Finland are just some of the countries expected to put forward some of their armed forces. The United Kingdom and Germany have said they'll only contribute logistically. This mission represents the European Union's first major military operation for 6 years.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A British newspaper is reporting that Al-Qaeda is training hundreds of European and American jihadis in Syria before telling them to return home to set up terror cells. From FSN's London bureau, Dan Whitehead reports.
The former member of the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, who spoke to the British newspaper at the border with Turkey, says some of those fighting the Syrian regime are being brainwashed by fanatics. It comes as British security services believe the threat of potential terrorists being sent back to the UK by al-Qaeda organisers in Syria is growing, with fears of up to 500 British people fighting in the country. The defector, known as Murad, says foreigners fighting in Syria are meeting to talk about terror attacks and about their pride in 9/11 and the London bombings. He claims British, French and American mujahideen were discussing places they wanted to bomb or explode themselves in Europe and the US. Last week in the UK, two 21-year-old men from Birmingham were charged with travelling to Syria to carry out acts of terrorism. Dan Whitehead, London.
A British appeals court judge has rejected allegations that the UK was involved in an American drone strike carried out in Pakistan. The case was brought to court by Pakistani man Noor Khan, whose father was killed in the 2011 attack. From FSN's London Bureau, Natalie Feary reports.
The 28-year-old's court case was supported by a human rights charity, Reprieve, which argued that UK intelligence was being provided to help US drone strikes. But the challenge was rejected on the grounds that Mr. Khan was asking a UK court to pass judgment on the US. During the court proceedings, lawyers for the British government said ties between the UK and US could be damaged if Mr. Khan won the court case. Natalie Feary, London.
There's more from us on Twitter. You can follow us there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
America must also face the rapidly growing threat from cyber attacks. Now, we know hackers steal people's identities, infiltrate private emails. We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now our enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back years from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy.
President Obama addressing the concerns of cybersecurity during last year's State of the Union address. From communication to conflict, the global importance of cybersecurity is growing rapidly. My guest for this special edition of FSN Reports explains why all of us, from governments to grandmothers, need to be ready for the dangers lurking online. The book is called Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know, and I began by asking co-author Peter Singer if the contents of the book will give people nightmares.
My goodness, I hope that's not the case, because it's almost the exact opposite goal of the book. The book goes into the very real threats that are out there. And, you know, look, it helps make it interesting as well. And, you know, the fascinating stories of, you know, everything from serious dangers and attacks, understanding Stuxnet, which is this historic new weapon that came out in our lifetime that people don't really know enough about, to using funny incidents to explain how the internet works, like the time that Pakistan accidentally kidnapped the world's cute cat videos for several hours. But the underlying point of the book, not to give away where we end on, but essentially is that when we're talking about cybersecurity issues, too much of the discourse has been either incredibly technical and so, you know, exclusionary to those of us that are not in the IT crowd, not the IT folks, or it's been like, you know, the movie Spinal Tap, you know, turn the volume up to 11, get scared. Sure. And oh, by the way, I've got the secret sauce solution for you, or I'm the man on horseback who's going to come rescue you. And instead, the ending of the book is, and what it walks through is how, as long, we need to recognize, as long as we are using the internet, and when I say we, that means everything from us as individuals, our kids, our businesses, our governments, you name it. As long as we're using the internet, we will have cybersecurity and cyber war issues to deal with. And so what we need to do is change our mentality towards it, understand the issues, and then we can better manage them. And so I hope the book is entertaining, but it's also a toolkit for, it walks through the key questions of, you know, how does this all work? Why does this all matter? And the last third of the book is, what can we do? There are things that we can do. And importantly, they're not incredibly complex or out of our reach.
You just mentioned cute cats and Pakistan. We can't just leave that hanging in the air like that. Tell us what happened in that instance.
What that episode, it played out back in 2008, was Pakistan was trying to, it took advantage of that trust. It was trying to restrict certain things that were on YouTube. And so to put it in layman's terms, its computers were communicating a false address for YouTube, and so all the other networks that were linking in got they trusted that an information was accurate, and they weren't. It was trying to block it, and so they started sending all their requests and information. And the irony here is not only did they accidentally kidnap all the Acute Cat videos, but they also overwhelmed their own networks unintentionally. And it's, again, the underlying issue here is the importance of trust. Now, it's a fun story, but it's a great connection to some of the major concerns that we have out there today. So the story of Cute Cats, it's a great, entertaining, fun way of connecting to some of the underlying fundamentals that matter in the system and talking about how we don't just need to understand them, but we also need to worry about what will happen to them over the next several years.
For a lot of people listening, cybersecurity perhaps has a more personal meaning, and that's just the simple everyday protection of their laptops or their PCs and their personal information, their private information. That's what they're more worried about perhaps than what's happening in terms of the NSA or WikiLeaks or the infiltration of the Chinese government. But for them, for people like me, isn't it simply a case of once you have a McAfee or a Norton antivirus and it's job done, you're safe?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I feared you might say that.
So you've hit it really well. Cyber issues, they, you know, are connecting to topics as weighty as the future of world politics and, you know, the relationship between the two great powers of US and China, to cyber terrorism fears. But it also hits us at our own personal level, the security of our bank accounts, concerns about privacy, what are our kids doing online? And note again, you know, these issues go back up the level, you know. The question of our own personal privacy, it matters to me as an individual, but it also connects to, you know, what should I should be thinking about these NSA things and when am I going to vote on it? But the underlying lesson, and in the book we, you know, the parts about what can we do, it goes from the international to the national to the business to the, you know, organizational, all the way down to you and I. What can we do? And importantly, it's key to understand that this is both the problems and the solutions are not about the software. They're not about the hardware. They're about the wetware. They're about the people. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get a solution from, you know, buying some secret sauce software. You're not going to get a solution from some new widget. Frankly, you're not even going to get a solution if you try and disconnect. It's about the way you approach things and the very human activities that you take, the organization you're in, the incentives. And so in the book, we go through some of the very key steps that people can take from changing your mentality from, you know, defense to resilience. Resilience, you know, think about it in terms of, you know, your human body. So in the book, we go through everything from, you know, good password security. Still the most popular password out there is passwords. The second most popular is 12345. Having different passwords for different accounts so that attackers can't daisy chain across them, which would protect a lot of people in the recent hacks of, you know, things from Target to Snapchat.
Well, I hope my mother's listening because I think you just gave out both of her passwords.
recently, my dad emailed me to say, well, don't worry, I have this certain kind of metric for my passwords. And I was like, Dad, you just emailed me that.
Right. So practice cyber hygiene like you would look after your own health, look after the health of your cyber activity. That makes perfect sense, I think.
It's an interesting point because too often we try and overcomplexify this, and frankly, entities, you know, take advantage of it, take advantage of our ignorance. It's not, you know, at the individual level, it's the hacker tricking you into clicking that link that you shouldn't have, or, you know, that email that you got from your mother saying, can you send me your bank account information? I'm stranded in Thailand. And you're like, oh, I didn't know mom was in Thailand, but I guess she needs my help. You know, there's actually a fairly easy solution to that. It's this amazing technology that this guy named Alexander Graham Bell invented, where, you know, guess what? Take the time to, when you're suspicious about it, call. If it turns out to be wrong, mom will be glad that you called. To look, the most important outside penetration of U.S. military networks by a foreign intelligence agency happened when a soldier found a memory stick in the dirt of a parking lot and thought it was a good idea to pick that memory stick up, take it into the military base and plug it into his computer. Again, to go back to, you know, that's not just a violation of cyber hygiene. That's a violation of basic hygiene. That's the 5-second rule. To, you know, the most recent episodes of WikiLeaks with Manning or Snowden, whatever you think about these individuals and their disclosures, we can certainly agree that the internal security practices that the military and the NSA were not following the kind of procedures that, frankly, a cupcake store should have for protecting its own internal networks.
Well, there were some security measures in place. When you talk about Private Bradley Manning, formerly known as Private Bradley Manning, and he overcame them with the most simplistic of forms, CDs and Lady Gaga.
Absolutely. He joked about how he was downloading not just ones and twos of files, but literally tens of thousands of files while jamming to Lady Gaga. And in turn, you know, the Snowden, he did everything from, you know, had folks sharing passwords with him to he was working in one cell, but gathering information from all different sides. So, you know, it should have been a massive anomaly showing up in the system in terms of the traffic. And then, of course, the downloading of that information. And, you know, again, this is something that actually these were procedures that they were supposed to be following, but they hadn't yet gotten around to implementing them. But again, it's not just the kind of procedures that a NSA should have. It's the kind of procedures that everything from a corporation to a human rights group needs, because guess what? We all face threats out there of very different kinds, very different shapes and forms. You know, everything from, you know, the classic Nigerian prince fraud to someone trying to steal credit cards to government agencies trying to penetrate to steal information, you know, targeting everything from defense companies to human rights groups. I work in a think tank. We were targeted as well. Mm-hmm. To, you know, these layers, what I'm getting at here is that there are things that can be done, and yet this topic area is one that we mystify too much. We think it's too technical. And the point of the book is to try and push past that and explain to people, you know, how it all works, why it all matters, what should you fear, what should you not fear, and here's what you can do about it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your think tank, the Brookings Institute, has been targeted. I have to ask you this. Isn't there a chance that you and your co-author Alan Friedman have potentially invited some sort of cyber backlash? I mean, not necessarily with any malice, but just to say, hey, we got the guys who literally wrote the book on cybersecurity.
I hope that you saying that doesn't actually incentivize that. But look, yes, in a certain way, but we're also all under some kind of threat, some kind of action. I would hope, though, one of the things that we've in the book, I think we are not being judgmental and are, in fact, far more empathetic towards some of the hacker collectives out there than the discourse that's been there. So as an illustration, when we explain the ignorance level that's out there, we talk about, you know, an episode where a U.S. military officer, you know, tried to tell me how Al-Qaeda and Anonymous are the same thing. That's just patently false. That's just absolutely wrong in everything from their means, their ends, their organization, you name it. And instead, in the book chapter where we explore what Anonymous is and how it does its approach, I think it helps people understand these groups that are out there. But the bottom line is that, yes, anyone who is online, myself included, at some point will have some kind of attack on them, some that they may know about, others that they don't. And hopefully we are all better prepared for it. But that's one of the things that we have to face. And again, we need to change our mentality from this because it's not just the direct impact of the attack, but it's how you react to it. It's frankly a lot like if we think about normal forms of terrorism. You know, think about the difference between the British approach of, you know, keep calm and carry on, versus our approach to some of these issues in the U.S. And it carries across to discussions of, you know, cyber terrorism. Cyber terrorism, as we explore in the book, there have been more than 31,000 articles in everything from mass media to academic journals about the phenomena of cyber terrorism. Mm-hmm. There have been zero people actually hurt or killed by cyber terrorism.
So do we strike it off the list then as something we don't need to worry about?
No, I mean, there are real dangers. You know, we wrote a book about it, but it's about approaching this with both awareness and balance. There are certainly dangers. You know, the other example would be the power grid going down danger that we all, you know, talk about in the narrative. Well, guess what? Squirrels have taken down the power grid more times than the zero times that hackers have. Now, does that mean that will never, ever happen? Absolutely not. We have the potential here. And in the book, we explore, you know, everything from the new type of weaponry that's out there, you know, that Stuxnet illustrated, to the wide range of actors, you know, from be they terrorist groups to state actors like a China and the United States that are engaged in building up cyber warfare capabilities. But it's all about understanding the differences between them, the risks associated with them, and then having a balanced response to them. And the best way to go back to what we were talking about before, the best way to be taken advantage of is to not understand that. And the best way to misapply resources is to follow the hype rather than the facts.
Sure. I don't think we can discuss your book and cyber war without talking about the relationship in this sphere between China and the United States, and in particular, the emergence of cyber espionage. You make it clear that it's not necessarily about the theft of political secrets anymore, that we've moved on to a more alarming concern, that of intellectual property, in particular, the hall of Chinese hackers.
I would argue there's no more important state-to-state relationship for 21st century security, stability, you name it, than between the two great powers of the U.S. and China. And yet, as we explore in the book, this issue of cyber is driving a divide between them that other issues are not. When we talked with both U.S. and Chinese officials, they would explain how, you know, look, we don't agree on be it trade topics or human rights or border disputes, but we know how to do the dance. When it comes to cyber, we're at a loss. And there's this great anecdote of a senior U.S. diplomat who is negotiating with the Chinese on cyber issues and asks us what an ISP is, which is, you know, a lot like going off to negotiate with the Soviets during the Cold War, not knowing what an ICBM is. Mm-hmm. And so this area is driving that. It's not just the ignorance, the confusion over, you know, basic terms, different interpretations and fears between information attack and what do they mean. It also connects to large-scale economic security questions. And that's just as what you noted, this massive campaign of intellectual property theft that's emanating from China. By one measure, it's the largest theft in all of human history. What's being stolen is everything from, you know, our classic definitions of intellectual property. So the designs of everything from the most sophisticated jet fighters stolen from aerospace companies to a small furniture maker in New England that had the design of a chair that it wanted to sell stolen. But maybe even the greater value has been penetrating into negotiating strategies and the like. So we've seen everything from oil companies to soft drink companies that were preparing to engage in negotiations, a bidding war and the like, and they'd get hacked. And guess what? The other side would know exactly what they were going to bid and, you know, either be able to top them or reject them or the like. And so when you're talking about things like, you know, an energy company, these are literally billions of dollars, maybe tens, hundreds of billions of dollars being lost. By one measure, this might be as much as $1 trillion worth of value going out the door in all these different ways, shapes, or forms. And of course, then the campaign is connecting to other areas, like we explore the incident where the New York Times was hacked. And it was not hacked because they wanted to, you know, find out, what was the New York Times going to charge for its newspaper the next day. Sure. What they were going after, interestingly enough, was who in China was speaking to New York Times reporters about corruption in senior government leaders' families. Basically, the New York Times was exploring a story about how come senior government leaders' families are so rich in China. And so this government-linked group went after them to try and find out, okay, who's spilling the beans? Mm. And this is just this enormous, important issue. As we joke in the book, China appears as often as cats do, because you can't talk about the internet without talking about cats. You can't talk about the future of the internet without talking about China.
Well, let's talk about the future of the internet. And you close out the book by looking at some of the coming cyber trends and cyber security challenges. And you use the term the Internet of Things, which happens to be maybe our second cat reference of the interview, or third now. What is it, and why could it cause such a major security headache in the future?
The Internet of Things is this incredible, awesome transformation of the internet and how we use it, and most importantly, in a way that will ripple out on the real world. So think about it this way. Cisco has said that, in effect, over the next 5 years, we'll see roughly 40 billion new internet-enabled devices link up. So when you're talking about those numbers, it's no longer, you know, you and I communicating with our devices, me emailing you from my computer to your iPhone or the like. It's devices that range from refrigerators to cars to things we haven't yet even dreamed, haven't yet been invented. And they're all coming online, and they're having conversations without us, without the humans. So we're already seeing little micro examples of this within certain networks. You know, if you've bought a new car recently, and say the brake pad's about to go out, your car, without you telling it to, will automatically communicate to the manufacturer, who will then automatically make an appointment for you at the local dealership. The next step on that is you're driving home in your car, and when you're 10 minutes out, it will automatically communicate to your smart thermostat. Guess what? Google just recently bought a smart thermostat company for $3 billion, which shows, you know, the kind of value they're putting in this. Mm-hmm. Your smart thermostat, which knows you're about to come home, will change the temperature in your house from the most efficient setting, because it's been linked to a smart power grid, and we want to save money, we want to be environmentally conscious, and then it'll change to the setting that you actually like it at. So you have this entire network of things interacting, all because they're online. Amazing efficiency, all sorts of great new steps for everything from, you know, quality of life to the environment, but of course it comes with certain threats. So to use that car example, we've already seen car hacking, where people have hacked a car. Cars now, you know, have hundreds of computers in them to cause the car to do something other than what the driver wants. So the Internet of Things will be this incredible change out there, but it also comes with new security concerns that we need to understand.
And finally, can you buy the book with Bitcoin?
Right now, it's available through both the publisher and bookstores and your Amazon.coms. So it's up to them to figure out whether to allow Bitcoin or not.
Peter W. Singer, who co-authored Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. Thank you so much for talking to us on FSN Reports.
Appreciate you having me on.
And that's the end of this special edition of FSN Reports. A reminder that you can contact the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. FSN Reports returns tomorrow with the latest news and features from our bureaus here in the US and around the world. That's tomorrow, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.